Greetings, friends, and welcome to Nature's Edge. This is Dale Stewart. We are having a very special show today with a good friend of mine, Dr. Michael Miller. Mike was with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention for 35 years until his retirement. Prior to retiring, he was the Associate Director for Laboratory Science for the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. Mike, he was for 5 years, he led the Laboratory Response Network, the LRN, which is a consortium of the nation's reference laboratories for the detection and confirmation of agents of bioterrorism. He has also served as the Chief Laboratory Science Officer for a major infectious disease center that was responsible for CDC's response to all foodborne, vector-borne, enteric, waterborne, zoonotic, and most viral diseases, healthcare-associated infections, and bioterrorism laboratories. Dr. Miller is a diplomatic of the American Board of Medical Microbiology, a fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology. He holds a number of adjunct professorships and has served on the editorial board of several journals. Currently, he is the director of Microbiology Technical Services, LLC, which is a private clinical microbiology consulting service for hospital and private laboratories throughout the United States. Mike has also written a number of books. He has edited a couple of books, and he's contributed chapters in I believe, 10 published texts, and has over 100 journal articles in peer-reviewed publications. I can also tell you Mike is an avid camper and outdoorsman, and he and I literally grew up together in Louisiana. Mike, welcome to Nature's Edge.
Thank you, Dale. It's great to be here. I really appreciate you inviting me, and it's almost like being home again.
It is, my friend. It's really, and it's great to talk to you. Well, Mike, I'm going to just jump in there with the thing that's on everybody's mind and have you talk a little bit about this thing called Ebola. Where did this come from, and tell us a little about Ebola.
Wow, this is really a headline issue at this point, and it's a global headline issue, and certainly timely for right now. So, you know, if you want to talk about several things, there's three huge big topics we could talk about. You know, the medical component, the technical component, and the personal touch component of patients. But let me say that CDC has been involved with Ebola outbreaks since at least 1976. That first one in 76 was actually in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and they have learned so much over the years, and thank goodness they are still leading the charge on this. Even though there's some public and political criticism, I'm still betting on CDC to tell us the right stuff. So right now, just to give you an idea of how huge this outbreak is, there's well over 4,000 cases, especially in West Africa, and over 2,200 deaths. And the death rate is very high. I believe I saw where one report indicated a death rate of around 70%, which is incredible. Now, this disease, Dale, is focused in a very local or very large area of Western Africa, in Guinea, in Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and then a couple of cases in Nigeria. And of course, unfortunately, we have some that have been imported into the United States, but only a couple so far. We are doing our best, everyone is doing their best to control this. So you wonder, okay, where did this come from? How did it get started, and where does this deadly virus live? We think this virus was at least linked to initially people that were hunting and eating gorillas and chimps in the jungle, or maybe finding dead apes in the jungle. But since there's no gorillas in West Africa, that kind of blows that theory for at least the West African component. So there may be a link to fruit bats in West Africa, where people eat fruit bats. And we know that these organisms, these viruses, can live in those bats. And so there may be infections in people that butcher these bats and get the blood on them, et cetera. And so therefore they're exposed to them and have a high risk of getting infected. There's also a lot of pig farms in Africa, and pig farms over there attract bats. So probably there's a link to bats in West Africa and maybe gorillas and chimps in other parts of Africa.
I was just going to ask you real quick, you're talking about the chimps and gorilla. Was that primarily in the Central Republic of the Congo, or what I used to call or still call Zaire?
There's certainly in that area. You know, there have been a number of outbreaks throughout Africa, so I can't pinpoint exactly where it may have started, but it certainly, let's just say, it was linked initially to eating those gorillas and chimps that were killed for their meat.
That's what I thought. Now, as far as we know, it's not airborne, correct, Mike?
What we've been told is that it is not airborne, that the organism is transmitted by direct contact with blood and body fluids of people who are exhibiting symptoms. Now, clearly, we see on the news and everywhere else where people are wearing protective masks, which would prevent even the small risk of an airborne infection. So right now, our science tells us that this is spread by touching blood, urine, saliva, feces, vomit, sweat, breast milk, even semen with our hands, and perhaps touching a part of our hand or finger that may have a scratch on it or something. So that's why people wear gloves and protective gear called PPE, or personal protective equipment.
Right.
But right now, we don't have any evidence that it is spread by aerosols.
Mike, have you ever known a virus to mutate from a bloodborne to an airborne?
One of the most genetically diverse viruses in terms of mutating is the influenza virus, and it mutates actually every year, and that's why we have to have a flu shot every year.
Right.
And so the chance of a mutation that would change the way an organism is spread is very, very rare. It's something that is unlikely, as opposed to just a simple genetic drift where there may be some minor changes in the external component of that virus. But to change the way it is spread, to change its mechanism of pathogenicity, that would be a huge, huge major jump that we just don't think has happened.
I understand. Let me ask you, what are our public health departments doing to combat not just Ebola, but infectious disease as a whole in the United States?
Well, I tell you, the national public health system is clearly the best in the world, and our people that work in every state public health laboratory, and many of the nation's largest cities have their own city public health laboratories, and they have worked very closely with the CDC on the federal side and their local constituents on the local side. So they are the liaison between those two huge agencies, and they speak both languages. So what they've done, using the existing skills in the bioterrorism laboratories, or the LRN laboratories, as you mentioned earlier, some of these LRN labs are actually now being used as laboratories that confirm the presence of Ebola or rule out the presence of Ebola in suspect patients. So their preparation over the years has made it possible for us to be as prepared as we are.
Mike, I'm gonna jump in. We're up against the clock right now, and we've got to go to break, and we will continue our discussion shortly. Welcome back to Nature's Edge with Dale Stewart. Today we're talking to Dr. Michael Miller. Mike is retired a few years ago from the Center for Disease Control, but he is still very much involved with the world of microbiology. And Mike, right before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about Ebola and the spread of Ebola, and what is the life of the Ebola virus outside of a host?
Well, the virus, all viruses essentially require a living cell in order to survive and multiply. So what protects this virus when it gets out of the body onto a surface, any type of surface, a table, a chair, a floor, or whatever, is that it can be protected by the body fluid that it is in. And so even if that body fluid dries for a few hours, that virus will remain viable. In other words, it'll stay alive for several hours. And if someone accidentally touches that contaminated body fluid and then rubs an eye or touches their skin or something like that, then that individual themselves can become contaminated with this virus and can initiate symptoms. Now, again, the virus is not contagious until the patient is symptomatic. And the incubation period, which means the time from initial contact until the first symptom begins, the incubation period is an average of 8 to 10 days, but it ranges from 2 to 21 days. And so that's why they are putting patients in isolation, or people who may have contact with these patients in isolation, for 21 days, because that's the longest of the incubation period for this disease.
Mike, I know last night I was I actually flew back to Western North Carolina from Cleveland, and there was a number of people in the airport talking about their concern for flying. Is there anything to worry about with people flying on airplanes right now?
Well, again, if there is a patient who is exhibiting symptoms that comes from one of these specific areas in West Africa, the risk of infection of someone nearby touching a patient's body or something like that, it may be higher. And in fact, as you know, just yesterday on the 14th, that second healthcare worker that had worked with the patient in Dallas who passed away, that second healthcare worker did exhibit some of those symptoms, and she actually was flying back to Dallas on Frontier Airlines. Mm-hmm. But the risk for flying is still very, very low. Unless this patient is somehow losing these body fluids and people are touching them.
Sure, sure. Do you think our hospitals around the country are pretty prepared? I know CDC sends out memos and notices all the time, particularly as it relates to infectious diseases. But do you think our hospitals are prepared for something like Ebola?
I think there are a few hospitals that are very prepared, especially those that have been listed among the hospitals that are receiving patients currently. Emory, Nebraska, NIH, you know, some of these other hospitals. The small community hospital, perhaps the average community hospital, while they want to be prepared to protect their healthcare personnel, being prepared also means being trained and having people who have not only seen a video and read a pamphlet about how to put on protective equipment, but they have drilled and practiced and practiced and practiced. And I'm telling you that being one that did this for anthrax during the anthrax outbreak, where I had to wear these uniforms, these suits, without practice, it is just very difficult to be confident in what you're doing. So the type of protective equipment that's being used, being trained and being drilled and putting it on and taking it off, having a partner to help you and watch and talk you through it is a very big deal. And I don't think the smaller hospitals and many community hospitals have that type of training. Now, they certainly have the skilled physicians, and they may have private rooms with private bathrooms, which was initially recommended. But I believe we're learning that we may need a little more than just some of those basic knowledge. We need to drill and practice.
Oh, I agree, Mike. As you know, I've done quite a bit of field work with various public health groups, including in Africa, and I've had to put on one of those suits a few times myself. And you're exactly right. It is something that we need to learn and move from. So the sick nurse could have become infected by the protective equipment itself, correct? The young lady that.
Well, you know, Dale, we really don't know yet. I certainly can't judge anything, but I do know that when taking this equipment off, when removing the equipment, there are opportunities to accidentally touch your skin, as the gloves are coming off or as the gown is coming off. So there's opportunities to do that. And I do not know when they actually started using the personal protective equipment, if it was at the very moment they saw this patient or later. I don't think we know all that yet. So before jumping to any conclusions, let's just say that taking this equipment off is risky in itself, especially for those who are not drilled and skilled in doing so.
Yeah, I agree. I know when I took the suit off that I was in Africa a number of years ago, it's everything you can do to keep, I just human nature, I wanted to reach up and scratch my nose.
And let me tell you a funny story, not kind of a funny story, but for those people who have been working in Africa for decades and this stuff, I've heard the stories come back from them when they were wearing this equipment. And, you know, you have to keep it on.
Oh, absolutely.
And they would get these African ants inside that equipment.
Yes.
Who may want to start biting, and you just can't stop and scratch every time you want to. You know, they had a really interesting story sometimes coming from those experiences.
Yeah, I can tell you about those ants. They're kind of like what we know in the South as fire ants. Those things
right.
They are brutal, and I've had several experiences with them in Africa myself. Mike, let's talk about treatment a little bit. What treatments are available? And I also noticed that one of the survivors, I think the doctor who was initially survived, wound up getting donating blood to some of the other patients. Could you talk about that just briefly?
Okay. The primary treatment, the best treatment so far, is supportive treatment. In other words, keeping blood pressures up, keeping temperatures down, keeping fluids in the patients because of the symptoms that are characteristic of this disease. And right now, there are three big fronts going on for drugs and vaccines. And, you know, we don't have a lot, but there's stuff that's going on. For instance, Health and Human Services is contracted to develop and manufacture a product called ZMAP, and they're doing that with a company called MAP Biopharmaceuticals. The National Institutes of Health are beginning to test an investigational vaccine last month, and they're working with a company to develop an antiviral drug, which we don't have an antiviral drug per se at this point for Ebola. And the Department of Defense is funding two companies, and they're working on drug therapy. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on that we really hope to see good news soon.
Yeah, we're coming up to on our next break, Mike, and when we come back, we'll try to wrap up this discussion about Ebola, because I want to discuss some other concerns with infectious disease with you. This is Dale Stewart, Nature's Edge. We shall return. We are back. This is Dale Stewart. You're listening to Nature's Edge, and my guest today is Dr. Michael Miller. Mike and I have been talking about Ebola, but I want to switch topics on you a little bit, Mike, and I want to talk about something that's kind of dear to me, and that's environmental concerns with infectious disease and with things out there in the wild that can cause us problems. Is that all right to go there?
We'd love to do it. Let's go.
How does our environment impact us in relation to infectious disease? We'll just start right there.
Man, what a great question. And I know your audience is anxious to hear about some of this stuff. And there is an entire new, relatively new science now called One Health. And One Health talks about the interactions between a healthy environment, a healthy population, and healthy animals, and how all of these are interconnected and connected, and how they balance with each other and the climate. And it is just fascinating. And we've learned so much in human medicine that we're learning the fact that we need to listen to our veterinarian colleagues about animal diseases. They need to listen about the human diseases. We need to listen to the climate people. When the climate begins to change, the vectors of these diseases are going to follow the climate that they are most comfortable with. They're going to cooler areas or warmer areas. And so this is a very interesting and dynamic concept. And I'm glad you're bringing it up, because we all need to be very aware of this One Health issue and how we interconnect with animals, environment, and people.
Mike, if we continue to ignore the environmental changes that we're seeing out there in the world today, then you're saying it will impact or potentially could impact our human health.
Well, it already has.
Yeah.
It already has. And you've seen, Dale, you've traveled all over the planet. I mean, you've gone into jungles, and you have seen where people have cut forested areas and so that they can move villages into those forested areas, and the inhabitants of that forested area, the animals, the insects, and they weren't asked to move. They weren't asked to leave, and they stay there. And they cause different types of, they cause now human infections. The same thing has occurred in the United States for decades. We've cut beautiful forest, put in nice subdivisions, but the animals and insects and everything else weren't invited to leave. This was their home since it started. And so we do see impact going on. And as the climate, as there are minor changes in, for instance, in temperature, there are some vectors like ticks, certain ticks and mosquitoes that have to survive within a certain temperature zone, and they're going to move to wherever that zone goes, and we're going to see diseases that we haven't seen before in the north may have migrated from the south to the north or the north to the south. So, yeah, it's going to there is going to be an impact. There already has been.
Let me ask you something. Since I'm out there a lot, and a lot of my listeners are also campers and like that I know you are, what's the best way for us to protect ourselves when we're out in the wild?
Oh, you said it 1,000 times, and it's kind of funny that you asked, because I know you know the answer. And that is, plan ahead and keep your head and just use common sense.
Absolutely.
For instance, one of the most common problems with novice campers and even some very experienced campers is that when people see water in the wilderness that's cool and crystal clear and beautiful, they think it's good enough to drink.
Yes.
But in fact, it can be a big risk. Giardia is a little parasite that fills our streams and ponds and lakes, and particularly in mountain streams and things. And this Giardia causes a very severe and most uncomfortable diarrhea. It's treatable, of course, but it's one of the most common infections that we see in our people who go camping, and children and adults. Water can be contaminated by animal feces.
Oh, absolutely.
You know that animals go to the edge of streams to drink, and while they're there, they may do what they need to do right there near the water, and it gets in there. And some thoughtless campers will do the same thing, not knowing how to develop a latrine system wherever they're going. So water can be crystal clear and cold and be very contaminated. In fact, as a microbiologist, I can tell you that you can have a million organisms per milliliter of water, and it'll be crystal clear.
Oh, absolutely.
So we're we have to use our common sense and be prepared to take care of our drinking water. The other thing is dirty dishes.
Yeah.
Not cleaning these dishes with, in my opinion, some soap and hot water. And I'm one that has always liked the hot water issue because that's going to get rid of things, most of it. Those are two very simple things that we have to think about that can cause some serious problems in people who just went to have fun. And Dale, you know that without planning and without common sense, fun can turn into disaster.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I'm so careful about, because as you know, Mike, most of my stuff is done solo, is just personal hygiene. I mean, just keeping myself as clean also as possible. And I've had Giardia, and I can tell you it is no fun.
I know what you're talking about, and I'm glad you're bringing it up to your audience.
Let's talk a little bit about something else that I'm familiar with, and that's ticks. Ticks can make you really sick, can't they?
Oh, man, yeah. And, you just can't stay away from them in the woods hardly. And these are interesting little creatures. There are about 14 different tick-borne diseases in the United States. Probably the four most common ones, names you may have heard about would be, can I just name some?
Like
Lyme disease. Rocky Mountain spotted fever, tularemia,
yeah.
Ehrlichiosis is another one. So I just don't talk about all 14 of them, but these are four of the main ones. And I'm wondering if your audience really knows how these ticks get on them.
Yeah, absolutely. We got about a minute left or a couple of minutes left.
Okay. Well, ticks are really smart. They find their host by detecting animal breath and body odors and sensing body heat. And what they do, these ticks get up on the very tip of blades of grass and hold on to that grass with their back two hind legs. Okay, the back two sets. The front two hind legs, the front two legs, rather, are open, like you're open-armed, ready to hug somebody, and they're just waiting and waving for somebody to walk by, and they reach out with those front two pair of legs, grab on, and they get under your body, find a nice, warm, moist place. They insert that feeding tube, which is sometimes barbed, and can inject saliva as they take a blood meal. And by injecting that saliva, they inject the organism, the bacteria, that is causing these diseases. And that's how we get sick with tick-borne diseases.
Mike, how do you take a tick off? We got about a minute left. How should I remove a tick if I get one on me?
Well, I can tell you how you don't do it.
All right.
You don't use fingernail polish. You don't use petroleum jelly. And you don't stick a hot match to their rear end. But the best way to do it is to use fine tip tweezers and grasp the tick very close to the skin surface, and then gently but firmly pull upward with steady pressure, trying not to break off those mouth parts, which will stay in your skin. Now, if you do break off the mouth parts, then try to get them with the tweezers, or either just leave it alone and let it heal. That's the best way to do it.
I appreciate that. You're listening to Nature's Edward L. Stewart, and we're talking with Dr. Michael Miller. And when we come back, Mike, we're going to talk about mosquitoes.
Horizon, I see.
We are back. This is Dale Stewart with Nature's Edge, and my special guest today, Dr. Michael Miller. Mike retired after some 35 years with the CDC, and we've talked about Ebola, and now we're talking about other things that we can run into the wild that make us sick. And Mike, you and I grew up together in the mosquito capital of the South, and so I want to talk a little bit about mosquitoes. Also, mosquitoes have a special place for me, and I don't know if you know it, but about 10 years ago, I got dengue, and I'm going to tell you, man, that's like flu on steroids.
You had breakbone fever, and it just hurts so bad you think everything's breaking apart, doesn't it?
Man, I tell you what, I got it in Central America, and I never want to experience that again.
You're right. You know, we, Dale and I grew up together in the same little hometown in Louisiana, and the mosquitoes, sometimes as big as birds, at least we thought at the time.
Absolutely.
But we survived it, and I think most everybody who's been in the wild has had this battle with mosquitoes. And there are some in the United States that carry disease. And the most... in other parts of the world, it's one of the biggest problems on the planet.
Right.
In fact, over 300 million people a year get infected with malaria and dengue.
Yeah.
And so that is just a huge group. But one of the most common mosquito-borne diseases in the United States is West Nile. West Nile virus. Back several years ago, CDC information showed that more than 30,000 people had been infected in the United States, and 1,200 of those unfortunately died. So this is usually not a death-causing disease, but it can be. Now, West Nile is one of those mosquito diseases. There's a couple of others. One is called St. Louis encephalitis. Now, encephalitis is an infection of the brain, kind of like meningitis. Meningitis is an infection of the covering of the brain, but encephalitis can be a little more serious. And St. Louis encephalitis is one, and another is called Eastern equine encephalitis, in which horses come into play a little bit. So that's the three main diseases caused by mosquitoes in the United States. We don't have malaria here, but you know, Dale, we used to.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
In fact, the original name of the Center for Disease Control, when it was first born, was Malaria Control in War Areas.
Actually, I knew that.
And it focused in the United States in the southern parts of Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana down in there, where we did have malaria many, many, many years ago, but not anymore.
Mike, what's the for our listeners out there, what's the best way really to combat these diseases in the U.S., mosquito-borne?
The best way to combat a mosquito-borne disease is to get rid of the vector, which is the mosquito.
Right.
So protect yourself when you're in the field. Don't neglect wearing the right type of mosquito repellent. Don't neglect taking a mosquito net if you have one, and the weight will allow you to do it. But protect yourself from the vector. That's the best way to do this. These are viral diseases: West Nile virus, St. Louis encephalitis, and Eastern equine encephalitis. And there are very few, if no, direct antiviral drugs to treat these.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful and wear appropriate clothing, cover your skin, and use repellent.
Mike, there's another critter out there that I run into frequently, and particularly when I'm out in the wild with the wild animals, and that's fleas. Any problem with fleas?
Well, you think, people are going to say, well, that's just nasty. But in fact, animals have fleas, and fleas bite animals, and fleas don't care who they bite.
That's correct.
And they will certainly bite people. So the flea disease we have in this country is essentially plague.
Right.
And that occurs primarily only in the southwestern part of the United States. But this disease plague is caused by a bacterium, and people can get sick after being bitten by an infected flea. Now, there's different types of this plague. There's bubonic plague, which you get fever and headache and chills, and you get swollen, tender lymph nodes. They can get as big as golf balls, these lymph nodes, and they're called buboes. Mm-hmm. And that's why you get bubonic plague is what that is. And you get the incubation period is about 2 to 6 days after you get bitten. But it can go into the blood from there, and it can be called septicemic plague. And that can cause the skin and the tissues to bleed within the skin, and that tissue can actually turn black and die.
Yeah.
And that's usually from flea bites or handling infected animals. And then the worst kind is pneumonic, as in pneumonia. It's pneumonic plague, where you get fever and headache, pneumonia, chest pain, and bloody mucus from inhaling droplets. And that's the most serious form. And this form, plague pneumonia, is transmissible person to person, but it's not transmissible from the other one. So you get fleas on any type of rodent, anywhere you see out in that area of the country, southwestern area of the country, prairie dogs, ground squirrels, mice, et cetera. Those animals are infected. The fleas bite the animals, and the flea becomes infected, and then the flea bites people, and that's how we get sick.
Absolutely. Any other flea diseases, Mike, that we need to know about?
Well, that's really the main one is plague. I mean, we could talk about typhus. There is another flea disease called typhus, but it's something that we don't see it very much, and so fortunately, in fact, we don't see plague much anymore either.
Yeah,
but it does occur in the United States. There's only probably less than 20 cases a year in the United States,
but it's
limited to that one part of the country.
Yeah, as you said, that's primarily the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona area, correct?
Yeah.
Mike, we got about 2 minutes left, and I would like you to sum up, just because I know this is on everybody's mind, if you would, a little bit about Ebola one more time for the listening audience.
Well, I'd be glad to. Ebola is a very dangerous disease, as everyone knows. We would call it a low-incidence, high-consequence disease because so many people die that get Ebola. But it is not something we need to panic about in this country, in the United States. We have the best health care in the world here. The diseases that we have are here in the United States are a result of people flying here from infected and impacted areas, and they are getting the best care that they can. So we don't need to panic. We don't need to judge people. We don't need to blame anybody. We need to support our public health laboratories in each state and support our federal laboratories that are working so hard to take care of it. But let me invite each listener that would like to go to the CDC website. And on that website will be all the information that we know about Ebola, whether it's in the United States or in West Africa or anywhere else for that matter. But it's a wealth of information, and they're welcome to go to that website, and there's plenty there to take a look at, as well as they can find each of these other diseases we've talked about, the tick-borne, mosquito-borne, flea-borne diseases. All of those are described pretty fully on that website. So I would welcome anybody to go there that would like to.
Mike,
thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Dale, I want to thank you so much for coming on and being open with us and talking not only about Ebola, but some of the other common sense steps we need to take in the wilderness. Until next time, this is Dale Stewart with Nature's Edge, and I will see you in the wild.